Before we get to this episode, just to say thanks to everyone who's bought my new book, Champion Thinking, How to Find Success Without Losing Yourself. Published by Bloomsbury, the response has been terrific. It's an Amazon bestseller. It's been top 20 in the airport charts consistently, and the reviews have been terrific right across the board. And if you like this episode that you're about to hear on Flow, you'll be sure to enjoy Champion Thinking. Head to my website, simonmundy.com, or Amazon, Waterstone, Smith's, places like that, to get your copy.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Hey, folks, it's Marc Maron from WTF. I've been talking to all kinds of famous people in my garage since 2009, including a sitting president.
You know, I don't imagine you were flying in here on the chopper thinking like, you know, I am nervous about Marc.
No, I wasn't.
Okay, well, that's good.
That would be a problem.
It would be a problem.
If the president was feeling stressed about
coming to my garage.
Coming to your garage.
And now there's even more WTF when you subscribe to the full Maron to get weekly bonus content and all WTF episodes ad-free. Listen to WTF wherever you get podcasts and subscribe to the full Maron at go.acast.com/WTF.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.
This is Don't Tell Me the Score, the podcast that uses sport to explore life's bigger questions. My name is Simon Mundy, and each week I sit down with an expert from the biggest sporting names in the world to Buddhist monks, neuroscientists, psychologists, and philosophers. We discuss a theme that tells us something insightful and important about life and how best to live it, from the importance of self-acceptance to facing addiction and developing resilience, right through to getting your circadian rhythms in sync and how to sleep better. Sport is a metaphor for life, and in this podcast, I aim to prove that right. I always like hearing from you, so the best way to get in touch is via my website, simonmundy.com, or I'm at Simon Mundy on social media. In this episode, I'm talking to the five-time Olympian and former rower Francis Horton about teams.
Hi, Simon. How are you doing?
I'm all right. How are you?
Yeah, I'm good, actually. Yeah, I'm enjoying this little adventure I'm on.
This little adventure you're on? Yeah. Just elaborate on that quickly.
So I've put together my learnings from my 21 years in rowing. And initially it was meant as a way of getting this stuff out of my brain. And then I thought, well, it would be really nice if I printed a few extra off and gave them to some coaches and some physios and doctors and things to say thanks very much for what I learned and what they helped me sort of experience and what we put together between us. And it seems to have sort of morphed a little bit. And it's just been a real pleasure to talk a bit more about it, because for me, it's just the start of a conversation. So, it's just been a bit of an unexpected adventure, but great fun.
All the best things morph, don't they? And I've got your learnings from five Olympic Games here in my hands. I love the title. Nice and snappy. That was a good one. I mean, it really does. It's the old Ron Seal thing. It really does say exactly what it does on the tin, doesn't it?
Andy Vernon did say to me, did you not think of a different title? And I said, well, not that many people can write that title. So I thought I'd just stick with it. It is what it says on the tin.
Absolutely. It really is. Speaking of rowers, I mean, I do love having rowers on Don't Tell Me the Score. So I've had Andy Vernon on, who not only have you won an Olympic medal with, but she's your neighbour that you can see basically, as you were just explaining to me, across a body of water near where you live.
through to Catherine Granger, Ben Hunt Davis. There's something special about rowers. I don't know what, I can't quite put my finger on it. Somewhat slightly masochistic in terms of the sport you do, yet all clearly deep thinkers and reflective.
Well, whether we like it or not, our training does involve a lot of doing one cyclical thing over and over, which then leads to a lot of time in our heads percolating on things. So, yeah, I think we become that way, even if we weren't that way to start with.
So you are a five-time Olympian. I mean, it's a very exclusive club, that, isn't it? So is it just you, Catherine Granger and Steve Redgrave?
Oh, gosh, I think so. Yeah, I know I was the fifth woman in any sport for Britain, sort of across different sports. And I think in rowing, that would be the three, but I would be mortified if I've forgotten someone.
Yeah, well, you and me both. But I'll tell you what, I mean, that is a fantastic club to be a part of. You as well. So you won three silver medals. You're a four-time world champion as well. And so today, basically, in terms of a theme, we're really talking about what it takes to make a successful team, along with many other themes within that. Because obviously, when you are rowing, whether it be, you know, in a two, a quad, or an eight, and I know you have experience across the board, the lessons you can learn about operating successfully with other people, about connecting with other people, that they are universal truisms that could be applied in any sphere of life. And rowing really, well, any sport, but particularly the rowing and the 21 years you spent really did help you zero down on the key elements of that. Is that fair?
Yeah, it really did. You know, it's a tough sport. It involves a lot of training on our own, and you can't get selected until you've proved yourself as an individual. And only then do you get into the crew. So there's this constant weird dynamic where you're sort of looking out for yourself, but then the only time you can really create incredible performances and work together with other people is this small amount of time each sort of spring and summer. But that is really where the enjoyment and the richness is of being involved in sport at that level. Mm. So, yeah.
So we're going to unpick a lot of the things that anyone could apply to make their team or be a part of a team more successful, more happy, more cohesive, more collaborative, all those kind of things. And in terms of the arc of your story, I mean, you certainly went on a journey. Now, basically, a guy called Mark, so hi, Mark, if you're listening, as and I hope you are, listener to Don't Tell Me the Score, got in touch to say that obviously, the word journey comes up a lot with these type of things. But I think it's hard to think of another way to describe what happened over your 21 years. Can you think of anything else other than the word journey to describe the evolution that you went on? Are there any other words we could think of, or should we just stick with journey?
I think we probably have to stick with journey. I mean, journey does kind of sound like you know where you're heading and you put the thing into the sat nav and it takes you there, which definitely was not the case. I guess it's a bit more meandering. And a few dead ends and things like that. But you know what? It was what it was.
It was. Okay, so sorry, Mark, journey it is. And in terms of what you learnt along your way, it did feel to me, in terms of me understanding your story, that you set out with a vision, really, of what you wanted or what you thought you wanted. And then over time, that evolved. And perhaps you realised that deep down, in terms of, you know, your heart's desire, actually your values and what you really, really wanted, it was broader than just what you focused on initially.
Yeah, to a certain extent, that's true. I think I started out very conscious of what I perceived was expected of me. And one of my values quite strongly is sort of duty. And I think that's the mindset I started with, was that it is my duty to fulfill what others expect of me. And I think my evolution was to come to a point where I said, well, actually, it's going to be healthier for me to detach myself from what others expect of me and actually do this for the reasons that are really powerful and meaningful to me and only me within myself as a person.
Where did that duty then, or that sense of duty, come from?
I think it's a sort of family value, quite a sort of disciplined upbringing, lots of sort of music lessons, and, you know, doing what was required on a daily basis in a sort of quite structured way. And I think I just felt like that's what the right thing to do was. You know, I was really, really well preconditioned for the world of rowing. I was very used to being given a set of instructions and doing them, and really being quite comfortable in a lot of structure and routine. So I guess I didn't, once someone said, look, I think this is something you could pursue and be good at, and there are certain things that you might be able to achieve, it would have felt like I was letting others down or falling short of what my duty was to fulfill if I didn't give that everything.
So within that duty, there was an element of approval?
I think now that I look back more, I'm sure there is, and I'm sure there's some kind of deep psychological theory about approval. But it was more duty than approval, I'd say. But I wasn't much good at other stuff, so I'm sure that the approval was quite exciting for me.
Of course, yeah. Look, I think everyone wants approval, don't they? But then what you said is that at a certain point during your career, you switched from, okay, doing this in terms of duty, in terms of expectation, others, to more like, okay, what do I want and how do I want to be? So it became very much more self-referencing.
Yes, and also looking back over the best experiences and the best teams I'd been in, and really challenging myself to be able to answer, okay, so what did I value most out of this experience, whether it was a gold medal or it was a disappointing silver or it was a fourth place, and saying, okay, well, I've got a limited time left. What do I want more of? Yeah, there was a definite shift.
What's interesting, I think, is as well, in becoming self-referencing and in becoming thinking, okay, what do I want? Still, the outcome seemed to be more connection, more collaboration, and more success with others, which is almost a little counterintuitive.
Yeah, absolutely. So, yeah, a lot of self-evaluation, and then realizing in answer to that question, it was, oh, the thing that actually I really, really value is that collaboration with other people, and realizing that my very best performances had come when I had a mindset not of, you know, what we're really supposed to win. It was actually, what can we create together in a sort of limitless perspective? Not that we were, again, fulfilling what others expected of us, but just saying, you know what, it's a clean slate and there are no ceilings. What is possible? Let's go and find out. And I knew when I analyzed that, I knew that not only did I perform best with that mindset, but it was also so much more enjoyable. So when I knew I had a limited amount of time left, I said, well, you know what, if I've got a limited number of days, if I could have as many good days as possible, this is what they'd be like. And then that really made me think, okay, well, if the absolute best outcome of this is that I could stand on an Olympic podium again, how do I want to feel when I'm there? Not what do I want to hold or what do I want to achieve, but actually, if I could stand there with my arms around my teammates and share a moment where we can completely look each other in the eye and celebrate each other for what we've put together, what we've been through, what we've seen in each other, well, if that is going to be a genuine moment, then that comes back to the everyday and really getting to know each other, really appreciating each other each and every day from that point onwards. It can't just come in that moment, not going to suddenly feel like that in that moment.
So it's an orientation away from this, okay, we're building towards this moment in the future where everything will be hunky-dory and there'll be rainbows and harps and all that kind of stuff, too. Enjoying every day, this day, tomorrow, the next day, so on and so forth. So it's an so it's changing from being future focused to now focused, and in the process taking care of the future.
Yes, but I would say it's not necessarily about enjoying it. I think it's so easy to say, oh, enjoy it, or I'm going to tell myself to enjoy it. Actually, it was saying, you know what, if I engage in every day,
yeah,
if I really sort of make sure I press pause in every day and say, actually say to people, I really care about you, rather than just thinking it but forgetting to say it, and saying, you know, this is a really special thing we're trying to do. It was that appreciation of each moment, and that one moment can lead on to another, onto another, onto another, in a building of momentum. That was really different to the enjoyment. And I think a lot of people had sort of tried to tackle this, oh, you know, don't worry so much about the outcome, you know, just enjoy it. You're really lucky to do what you do, and you're going to go to the Olympics. And it's like, yeah, but I can't just tell myself to enjoy it. I really needed to shift my perspective on each day.
Mm. It's a bit more about meaning, because special things aren't always enjoyable, meaningful things. If I think of building a career, anyone who has kids knows as well, you know, they aren't, it's not always enjoyable, but it's that meaning side of it. So is that what you're getting at, the meaning? And then it is interesting that your definition of success changed, and this is something that's come up quite a few times on this podcast, as well as I've mentioned some of the rowers as well. And I spoke to Kath Bishop, who's incredible, and she was talking about the moving from the zero sum definition of winning and winning at all costs to a bit more of exactly what you're talking about, collaboration and cooperation, while still striving to win. Obviously, Pippa Grange, the same thing. So this does seem to be a conversation that is naturally bubbling up at the moment.
Yeah, it is. I mean, I think this percolation started when I actually looked back, and I know Kath mentioned this as well, but I think it was about 2010 or 2011, and I studied Latin at university. So I was always been interested in what the real, again, meaning of things are. And when I understood that competition actually comes from the word competere, which means to strive together, it doesn't mean to win and it doesn't mean to beat, but it's this striving. And around the same time, I was reading a biography of Roger Federer, and I know you're a huge fan of Roger Federer as well, but about, he talks about he needs the opposition to bring out his best. And that's where I really started to shift this thinking. And I think alongside that as well, you know, when I first started in Sydney, Atlanta, there was only one gold medal, and that was in rowing. Sydney, we had 10 gold medals. And the people that were returning home as Olympic champions really were household names. They were sort of legends and heroes. But once we started winning so many Olympic medals, and especially those gold medals, Beijing, London, and Rio, the reality just wasn't matching the expectation. People weren't returning with a sort of life shifted. You know, I think many of us would struggle to name every member of the women's hockey team that won gold, or every member of the men's sprint team that won gold in London, for example. And I think for many athletes, there's a sense of, okay, so what else am I getting out of this? Because the medal isn't going to change my life, as it never should have, in my opinion, sort of had that expectation. But there's a real reality now that there are so many British Olympic gold medalists that inevitably, I think what people are looking for in it is maybe a slightly richer, longer lasting thing.
Yeah. Goldie Sayers, I always like how she describes, she won her Olympic medal 11 years, I think, after the actual event because of drugs cheat. And she got the medal, and she now says it has pride of place above this recycling bin. And it's almost this slightly comic thing that doesn't hold quite the same luster that she imagined it would. And much like you, it was then reflecting back on the other things beyond just the medal. I liked what you said about Roger Federer there, by the way, as well, in terms of needing the competition to essentially create something. Because I think of his greatest, considered to be his greatest final, 2008 with Rafa Nadal, he lost. Yet to be able to look at that and think, well, I was part of a masterpiece, part of painting something really special that's a really lovely outlook, and one quite at odds with the narrative that we have been fed for a long time, which is winning is all that counts.
Yeah. And I, you know, I think once I understood the power of altering our perspective on something that you think is a really set thing, it's almost like the doors opened. It's like, oh, everything can be seen from different perspectives. And I actually, the other day, interestingly, I also read that the root word for rival is this Latin word rivalis. And actually that it's not like rival like we think of it now. It means one person using the same stream as another. And I think that really fits as well with the sort of Roger Federer story as well. You know, he's got this huge rivalry, as you say, with Rafa Nadal and Novak Djokovic. And he just really simply seems to be okay with that. And I mean, I'm sure that it's way, way more complex than that, but the grace with which he handles it, he sees real positive in the fact that they are both swimming this same stream together.
Mm. Yeah, absolutely. And it does say something perhaps as well, do you think, about not just sport, about there's room for a bit more collaboration within the competition that exists in, say, business and the world we've created anyway.
Yeah, I do. For me, I get so much more out of it when I'm appreciating the moment of working together with other people. And, you know, it's a bit like, I think I really like gardening. And I think of it like...
Very good for you. Very good for you.
Yeah. But whenever I'm gardening, it's not like I want to get it done. DIY, I want to get done. I want it over. I want that whole field. But gardening, I just enjoy doing it. And there isn't this end point, and there isn't this achievement at all. It's this thing that is continually, as you say, evolving. And I think the sort of final hurdle is to give ourselves permission. It's okay to enjoy doing things. It's okay to say, actually, you know what, being really engaged in working with other people, that for me is a huge part of the reward of doing this. And I remember at one point thinking to myself, look, I've got 2 years left. What is going to make the next 2 years of a lot of hard work worth it? And I thought, well, actually, I've got this opportunity to look back and think about the things that I value the most. And actually, if out of these last 2 years, I could really, really have memories of working together with incredible people. I mean, there are so many people on the rowing team that will never sort of see the light of day in terms of sort of exposure and fame, but they're incredible, incredible human beings. And the privilege to work together with someone, and you sit down over breakfast and you're saying, right, you know, let's see if we can be the best in the world. And they're like, yeah, what should we do? What's the next session?
Thank you. Absolutely.
Yeah. It's just brilliant.
I like what you said about gardening. It reminded me of, do you know Alan Watts, the old philosopher?
No, I don't.
Check him out. You'll like him. Okay. Anyway, he said something along the same lines, which is it's like with dancing, you know, you don't dance, perhaps we do these days with Strictly to get the scores, but ignoring that and into the classic dancing, you know, you don't dance to reach the end point. You dance for the enjoyment of the dance itself. Same even with music and a concerto. Yes. It's not just about the last note. It's everything as you go through it. And that's exactly the same that you're talking about in terms of gardening and these other things. So before we get into, because you have, there are actually lots of specific little nuggets and lessons that we can talk about as well. But I've picked just a couple of the key points throughout your career, studiously avoiding the word journey, but along your journey. So your first Olympics was 2000. After that, you decided, right, I'm going to squeeze in as many as possible and count it on your hands. Right, I can keep going for another, however many, you know, another four Olympic Games. 2004, just really quickly, real quick, just a nod to Rebecca Romero, who you were in a boat with, because she went on to win the an Olympic gold in cycling. Can you pay homage to Rebecca, you know, as a rower and cyclist?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, to sit behind Bex in a rowing boat, every time we raced, we'd sit there on the start line and I'd think, I'm not sure how this is going to go. The green light would come on and we would piece together the very best strokes that we had done in all of training, stitched together the best start, the best middle, the best end. And that's what Bex was. She has this ability to piece it all together. Wonderful perspective, amazing athlete, so exciting to row with. We won the World Championships together the next year in rowing. She then got injured and did a lot of training on the bike and, switched to cycling and applied just her mentality, her talent, her humility, her simplicity to cycling. And she won in Beijing, individual gold medal, just absolutely incredible.
I mean, it is, isn't it? Now, I often ask, most of the time off air, but my guests to suggest a guest for a future episode of Don't Tell Me the Score. Obviously, you and Bex are close. So can I leave that with you to sort that out?
Thanks for that.
I think that's a yes.
Yes.
Okay. Let's move forward to 2008. So you won silver medal. Now, I've already spoken to Catherine Granger and Annie Vernon, and it was hard actually talking to both of them about it because I know for them it was incredibly traumatizing to win a silver. For Dame Catherine Granger, she'd won silver in 2000 and 2004, and not winning gold was, I mean, she described it as being like a bereavement. And I know Annie took it pretty hard as well. And when I spoke to her, I could sense her clam up, if you like. So to finish the trilogy of chats about this harrowing silver medal at Olympics, what was your take on it?
I can tell you're excited about completing this, this group. Yeah, we'll have to get Debbie on as well. So my overriding memories, I mean, I remember crossing the line and Catherine gave out this, I mean, it wasn't a groan, but it was just this noise of pure frustration that said, I will never, ever be able to turn back the clock 6.5 minutes. Like, that's all I need is to turn back the clock in time, and we can't. And we've failed, and there is nothing we can now do about it. 7 minutes ago, we had the opportunity in our hands to influence this in a different way. I mean, it was just heart-wrenching. And for all of us, I think, we had our heart set on winning gold. But, with a bit of perspective on it, the other crews in the race, there were probably three favourites going into it. The Chinese had beaten us over the course of the last few years. They were very much primed in their home Olympics. And the Germans had never lost the event in the history of the Olympic Games. And I think that actually sitting on the start line, I looked at Catherine's, all I can see is Catherine's head. And every other World Championships we'd been to together, she'd always had her hair cut. She was so ready. And I remember realizing that she hadn't had a chance to cut her hair. And I just thought, oh my goodness, we just haven't had enough space for ourselves over this last 6-8 months. It sort of summed it up for me that we hadn't left enough space for ourselves, our personalities, our souls, our sort of all the peripheral stuff that for me, I know for me to perform at my best, I need to be able to bring myself as well as myself as an athlete and my skill set in a boat. And I think in our absolute desire to win, we trained really, really, really hard and just didn't leave enough space for us to be able to bring our full selves.
So is that a bit about self-care then? Some of the stuff you talk about in terms of, your pillars that you need personally to be at your best, somewhat neglecting some of the stuff you need individually?
Yeah, I just remember about 6 months through the year saying to Annie, you do realise that we don't have another Saturday or weekend really free for ourselves, real downtime between now and after the games. And I thought, gosh, this is going to be really hard to handle.
Do you think if you'd had downtime, that could have made a difference then?
Well, I just think we maybe would have made different decisions. I think the perspective changes on the everyday, a bit like I mean, now I can really tell if I'm a bit tired. Yeah. I just don't cope as well. I don't make the same decisions. I don't see things with perspective. And even if it didn't change the outcome, if we had had a bit more perspective, then I think we would have seen the silver medal slightly differently.
Let's fast forward then to 2014, which was a seminal moment for you in terms of, so you were burnt out at this time, and it forced you to reflect, to stop, to look back and explore what worked, what didn't, the way you were doing things. So what led you to this point of being burnt out, and what came from that?
Yeah, so I was obviously really conscious that I still hadn't won, and I felt like it was one of my goals was to win the Olympics. And I had had a standpoint of whatever crew I was in saying, look, we can do it, and this is how we've done it before. This is what we need to do to, you know, to win. This is what it should feel like. But the crews were getting slower and slower. I was getting more and more frustrated, and I was passing that frustration on to my teammates. And it was just not really much fun to be around me. And it wasn't the experience for other people that sport should be either. And this constant pushing, although it was well-intentioned, it just led to me getting injured and ill over and over and over again, until the point where it was really my body's last way of telling me, look, you've got to stop. You can't keep pushing. You can't keep pushing yourself, and you certainly can't keep pushing others. And so I had a back injury. I was lying on my living room floor. I think it was about 10 days, 2 weeks, simply swapping a bag of frozen peas for a hot water bottle, peas for the hot water bottle, over and over again. And it was like this was the physical manifestation of the emotional load that I was carrying and not at that point processing in the right way. So it obviously came out in injury. And I remember at the time, I don't know if you know, like the film Philadelphia, there's a Bruce Springsteen title track, and it starts, I was bruised and battered. I couldn't tell what I felt. I was unrecognizable to myself. And that is, for me, always summed up that time, because I was numb. I was so stripped down. I knew it wasn't working. I knew others had sort of lost their faith that I could be a part of good crews and teams. And I was essentially sort of stripped bare and didn't really have the energy left for positive emotion. So it just took time until I was able to sort of re-engage my brain and realize, you know what, something's got to change. Like, it'll be a miracle if you get back in a boat, and an absolute, I don't know how you're going to get back to the Olympics, but I still believed it was possible. I still believed I was capable, but I had to change how I thought about it, because it wasn't working. It was miserable for other people. And I had I had 2 years left. So the way I see it now is, I sort of reconciled myself with not winning and said, you know what, I'm going to shake hands with defeat and say, okay, fair enough. I'll let that version of me go.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
You know how to book flights and hotels. All you're missing is a tool to plan the travel experiences you'll have once you arrive. That's why you need Viator. Book guided tours, excursions, and more in one place. There are over 300,000 travel experiences to choose from, so you can find something for everyone. And Viator offers free cancellation and 24/7 customer support for worry-free travel. Download the Viator app now and use code Viator10 for 10% off your first booking in the app. Find travel experiences for you. Do more with Viator.
Without the ones like you, who work tirelessly to keep things running, everything would suddenly stop. Hospitals, factories, schools, and power plants, they all depend on you. No matter the weather, emergency, or time of day, you're the ones who get it done. At Grainger, we're here for you with professional-grade industrial supplies. Count on real-time product availability and fast delivery. Call, clickgrainger.com or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Because that version of me had to go. And that was when I redefined success, because it's all very well saying, well, I'm not going to think like that anymore. That doesn't work. But I had to, if I was going to carry on and attempt to get to Rio, I had to sort of have something that really meant to me clearly what the ultimate experience in sport could be, but for that not to be reliant on winning. And that's when I really did a very proactive, reflective process of looking back over the best crews, thinking, okay, what did I value? If I could get to that end point of a podium again, how would I want to feel when I stand there? And actually, how do I bring about my best performances? And all of these things converged, this realization that it wasn't about being focused on winning. It was actually being focused on what can we create together. And that mindset, and that was when I sort of came up with this vow to myself that what I wanted to achieve was to stand on the Olympic podium with my arms around my teammates, sharing a feeling of joy, not relief. Absolute joy and the ability to look each other in the eye and celebrate each other and what we had created, and not relief that it was over. I was pretty sure that if we'd won in Beijing, I would have been relieved that we had won. And I had crossed the line in London and I was pretty relieved that was over. And I knew that I would probably be in a crew with people who had not won an Olympic medal before, who possibly had been to a games or two before, but, you know, maybe not achieved what they wanted to achieve yet. And getting to the Olympics is really, really, really hard. And I just felt like I owed it to anyone that I rode with to be able to say, you know what, this is an amazing achievement. We should never be relieved. We should be really proud of ourselves. And when I had that clarity, it was like this hose pipe of stress that had, you know, in the garden again, when your hose pipe is all like twisted and the water won't come out and then it bursts out and it's just, there's just so much tension everywhere. Yes. Once I'd sort of figured this stuff out, that's when the hose pipe untwisted and things started flowing again. And oh my goodness, I can't tell you how quickly my injury went away. I didn't get injured again in those last 2 years. And I was just so different to be around. The really tricky thing was to hold on to that mindset in an environment that is very much focused on making sure that we get results. And so that was tricky, but I just knew almost that this point in time was a line in the sand that I would not let myself walk back over. I'd said goodbye to that person. I'd shaken hands with defeat, and that was that. This was a different way forward.
That's fascinating. Everything you've just said, there's so many little bits. I don't know where to start. First of all, you did win silver as part of the eight in 2016. And the picture of you on the podium is exactly that. The joy of being alongside your teammates, rejoicing in the experience that you had and what you'd managed to achieve. It was abundantly clear, particularly in comparison to the picture that I've seen of the 2008 silver medal. it was just so clear that the joy was just absolutely coursing through all of you. And, you know, you did achieve that. The other thing, I think, in terms of, you know, letting this version of yourself die, if you like, and, you know, I wouldn't want to say that it was a breakdown or anything like that, but it did make me think of something that I've read about from Alain de Botton, who I quote occasionally, who talks about the value of an experience like that, insofar as often if you do get burnt out or hit the end of a, you know, hit a wall, it can actually end up being a really valuable experience if you can learn and shed those parts of yourself that are no longer serving you. So even though I'm sure it was an incredibly unenjoyable experience at the time, clearly it proved to be very valuable for you. Is that fair?
Yeah. I mean, I think I quite often think in terms of images, and I think of it like almost a crevasse, very, very deep, dark crevasse. But to get out of this, there are these, you know, sort of, or even like a, you know, a wound in the hand, which we would have a lot in rowing, like a broken split in the hand. And as the skin reheals over, it's those strings across that, the threads that start stitching it back together, the value is in each of those threads. I mean, no one wants to be down in the hole, but it's those bits that start stitching it back together. And the more of those threads there are, and I know Dr. Pippa Grange referred to the resilience that is formed from building back up. And that's certainly what I felt, was that by building back up each of these strings was actually a learning of self-respect. That's what I was rebuilding, self-respect.
Yeah.
And that's what I would, because I had these strings on the way up, closing that gap and holding it sealed. When I was challenged in the future, I had all these layers that were almost like a trampoline holding me up again. Mm.
I think it can be really encouraging to think about this, because right now, obviously, lots of people are going through challenging situations. And when we're in the thick of it, it can be really unpleasant in whatever guise it may come. But as you've shown, and I can think of so many examples where this is true, actually, what at the time is a very unpleasant experience can end up, you just don't know, can end up being one of the most valuable in important parts of your life in terms of the direction you then choose to take. It, obviously, it depends to what degree you can learn the lessons from them and listen to your body, for example. But that does, so this is a universal thing that I hope people, anyone going through a tricky time, can take some solace from, that it's not, you know, it may end up yet being something of a blessing.
Yeah. And of course, it never feels like that at the time.
No,
but I think even by surviving it, you are already repairing in some way. So actually, it doesn't need to be a really deliberate, proactive, challenging process.
Just get through it.
Just getting through it. But I think something that's also really important to remember, and especially for now, is the energy it takes merely to survive challenge such as this and adapting to change is huge. And I think I often saw it in athletes where they would get through a really challenging patch, whether it was a particularly close world championships, qualifying for the Olympics, or injury, and then they'd come back and say, well, you know, I've qualified, or I feel better, you know, I'm sort of on top of things now. But there would always be this lag, and then there would be the exhaustion. It's almost like a post-viral fatigue. And I think we cannot give ourselves credit for the amount of energy and the amount of our soul it takes merely to survive during difficult times.
Absolutely.
So we should all give each other lots of space over the next few years.
Absolutely. Here. And then another thing that you said that I wanted to pick up on was just the fact that you had these injuries and you traced them back to having an emotional origin. And again, Johnny Wilkinson pops in my head just because he said the same thing after, when he went through just an unbelievable sequence of injuries, and that he again felt that it was, you know, his body or whatever giving him a message to, he needed to do things differently. And it was like, no, you haven't learned the lesson yet. Okay,
yeah.
here's another one, until finally. And so the emotional impact of on injury, whether it be in sport or anything like that, What could you speak about that generally? Because obviously it's not, if someone is suffering an injury or ill or whatever, the natural or the normal way of doing things is to look at very much just at the symptoms and treat them perhaps. But what you're alluding to is actually the emotional origin in some cases of these things.
Yeah. I mean, I think talk to any physio on any sort of elite team, and they'll talk about this peak of presentation of physical injuries around moments of peak stress, so trials or, you know, competition time. And I don't think I would be so clear about having this perspective on sort of physical and emotional stress coming together if it hadn't. Once I had clarity in my mind and calm, once I had calm in my mind that I didn't get injured again. I mean, there was just nothing clearer to me than that. I mean, even in Rio, my back started to niggle again. But the day after the final, absolutely fine. So it's not like it suddenly healed itself. It was the emotional load that was released. So I think it's something always to look out for.
Yeah, your body just giving you signs, basically.
Yeah.
So that's your route and into 2016, thereafter you retired. And let's dig into just a couple of a few of the key things that you did learn in reflecting. And as you know, I've picked out quite a lot of them that we could discuss. But of the ones I picked out, whether it be, you know, belief, vulnerability, trust, identity, which of the, in terms of teams and stuff, which is the one that stands out for you?
I think possibly the aspects around giving each other in a team permission to believe in ourselves as people, and that we were capable of doing what we were trying to put together. I'd sort of seen it time and time again that, you know, if a crew had a bad day, they sometimes, was almost like this hole opened up underneath them, and a sort of immediate, oh, well, you know, that just proves that we're not good enough. And I really wanted to bring to the final teams I was in a real calm assurance to say, yes, you can. Yes, we can. And it's okay to be yourself as well. I can really believe that in a sporting context anyway, we're all our most powerful as our natural selves. Mm. When we're not inhibited, when we're not trying to emulate someone else, when we're not trying to reach a standard that someone else has set. And so that is what, you know, coming into that last year, I wasn't the best in the crew. I knew that I wasn't going to improve that much physically. My skills in the boat were, I mean, they were fine, but they weren't going to improve a huge amount. But what I could have a contribution to was, so all the other aspects other than power and skill, I could really ensure that every single person in our team, and that was more than the nine of us in the boat, we had reserves, we had, you know, we started out as 14 of us at the beginning of the year, but that we all felt that we could bring absolutely ourselves as people. And again, this sort of came back to my thinking of, well, at the end point, if we want to stand there and feel absolute pride at what each of us has done as a person, then each and every day, we should have full permission to be ourselves and explore the very best of each and every one of us, what we can do and express and offer to each other.
A couple of quotes that you've got. So again, just to pick up on a couple of things you've said, a couple of quotes in terms of belief. One that I like that you said is, it's not believing that you will, but believing that you can. And then also this idea of, as well, taking belief from others. So they've done it, why can't we? And I think of when I chatted to Ben Hunt Davis, you can apply this not just in sport. So setting up a business, for example, can be a bit of a, or writing a book can be a bit of a daunting prospect, but then you can look and think, well, they've done it, so why can't I? And you applied that philosophy in your sporting career, and then that whole, you know, knowing, okay, on we could do it in terms of we are capable of it. Doesn't mean that we guaranteed that we are going to do it, but that we can do it, and that's where the belief comes from. And it's a bit more freeing. And then in terms of, you said being at your most powerful as your most natural selves, that's around authenticity. And I really strongly believe, again, this is just a totally universal thing. In my world of broadcasting, people finding, if you like, their authentic broadcasting voice, I've always been surprised in hindsight, actually, how challenging that can be for people, because people may turn up to a job and think, oh, there is a certain way that we should do things. And I'm sure that's probably true in any sphere. But the more you can actually connect with, you know, the real you as much as possible and live it fearlessly, the more kind of successful and happy you can be and able to connect with others. So it's,
it takes, absolutely. You've put it so articulately. It takes a lot of energy to be someone else or to put up on a front. And I think actually Chris Hoy in your interview with Sir Chris, he talked about this really eloquently about almost like me to me, not comparing oneself to other people. And that's certainly something that I found. And I think it's really important to remember, I think.
Yeah, it makes me think, because, you know, we all are, we're the same, but we're all unique. Mm. And you can't compare yourself to other people, because you can only be you, you know. And then it's a funny one, because I know certainly in my life I've had times where I thought, oh, I'm a bit broken in this area or that area, and then you go around trying to fix it. But actually, for me, it's not about fixing things, it's about accepting things. And then perhaps, you know, you can obviously work and improve in certain areas, but it's about accepting who you are, warts and all. And I've actually, this is why I've got a bit of an issue actually with the whole idea of self-esteem, because self-esteem is about rating yourself, I think. You know, how do you esteem something is how you rate something. Whereas accepting, self-acceptance or acceptance of others even, that's different. It's no, you're absolutely fine as you are. And I think that's a really important distinction that I believe. What do you make of that?
Well, yeah, I mean, I often remind myself that if my partner's annoying me, I do think, well, you know what? Like, if he wasn't here, the things that you would miss would be all those really annoying things.
Absolutely.
They're a part of, they're our texture. It's just not possible to be perfect. And who would want to be? I mean, where's the nuance?
Can you imagine being hanging around with a perfect person? How irritating would they be?
Completely.
And you said another one you talk about, which relates to this as well, was self-awareness. So you learned about your driven side that you really consider to be a strength, and actually your view of it somewhat changed.
Yeah, so we did a little bit of personality profiling on two occasions in the team. The first time back in 2004, and I actually remember that. So we drew out on the ground sort of extroverts on one side of the room, introverts on the other side, and Bex and I, Rebecca Romero and I, are more of the introverted side of things. And I think one of us just opened the door because we were so unhappy with someone else being in the same zone as us, wanted to get even further away. When I did it again just before Rio, and I sort of read back over my profile, and initially when I read it, I thought, oh, you know, this is great. Who wouldn't want to be around someone who's really focused, always pushing the standards, really demanding, like always sort of looking at, you know, how every day, how can we be better? Then I sort of looked around at everyone else in the room and could see that actually that is too intense. And what I realized, that what I perceived as a super strength was actually super destructive for other people. And that was when I thought, okay, for this to work optimally between us, well, number one, that's probably why I have burnt out in the past, because I'm pushing. But there's a scale here, and there's a point where a super strength is too much, both for ourselves and for those around us. And actually, the impact I was having on other people was really negative. and it really encouraged me to look at things, you know, from other people's perspective, and also ask others for help. I think that was a really big thing in terms of vulnerability for me, to say, actually, you know what, I do need your help, and I really value it. It's not all about pushing forwards. So I dialed down what I initially thought was a super strength, and really left space for others to fill, and for us to be like an amalgamation of lots and lots of really positive, strong energy.
Mm. This is something that I really admire about people who get to play sport, is that the processes that you go through to be able to uncover these things, because how many people in so many other industries will be operating in a way and think this is my super strength, unaware of the impact it's having on other people. But in sport, because of the amount of time you spend reflecting and training and getting input, that you have this opportunity to develop this self-awareness, and how valuable it is to, and actually how strong you had to be to take that on board as well.
Yeah, I mean, I think especially in a sport like rowing, where we're doing the same cyclical motion over and over and over again, so much in our life is the same day after day after day. So it is possible to analyze one day against another and say, okay, well, this is the impact that I had on this day was X, because today was should have been the same as yesterday. And I look at sport now and I think of it actually almost like it's a slow motion explosion of all these different elements of life, and sort of our sort of meandering through life as people, whether it's vulnerability, whether it's self-awareness, whether it's how we deal with pressure, whether it's how we communicate with other people, because we're doing the same thing day after day after day, and we can analyze one race and then another race and actually ping out, okay, well, that was a matter of we just didn't communicate well, or that was because, you know, I thought you were fine, but I didn't realize you were struggling, or whatever it is. And I think having had that ability to see things element by element, I could now apply that now that sort of I'm on the other side. So what I learn under pressure helps me understand myself now in terms of my personality, how I cope with stress, how I interact with people, even though life outside sport is so much more complex.
Yeah, of course. Yeah. And having that awareness of knowing how you react under pressure is incredibly valuable, isn't it? So self-awareness, you talk as well about vulnerability. Obviously, you used to talk about, you know, sharing with others didn't make them faster, it made us faster. You talk about the best teams bringing more out of each other than they could out of themselves alone. And then trust. So which takes time to build. Trust is obviously a key part of teams.
Yeah, it was. And and this was really key for our crew in 2016. You know, our coach sat us down on day one and said, look, the thing that's going to make the difference between you doing and delivering what we know you're capable of and it for some reason slipping through all of our fingers in the last sort of 24 hours or in the middle of the final is you really understanding each other and actually building a level of trust in each other, in what we agree is the way we're going to row and race, that will withstand the pressure of being in the Olympic final. But he also said, look, that doesn't come from just looking each other in the eye today and saying, yeah, I'm up for it. You know, it's going to take time to build. It's going to take, you know, getting to know each other, support each other over the next few months. And you know what? You will have to compete against each other for your place. But through that process, you're going to really come to understand each other and see how far each of you is prepared to go for what you want to be a part of. And that respect that you will come out with will be, you know, one of these layers of trust day after day after day of seeing and understanding each other. Mm. And, you know, boy, did we need it, because we were coming last in the final. So She was right.
And a key part of building trust is obviously vulnerability. And I think back to an amazing story that Dame Catherine Granger told me, which was before her first Olympic silver, the night before, when the team psychologist said to each of her crew, or asked them, why are you doing this? What does this mean to you? And in sharing that with each other in a way that they hadn't previously, in the last 4/5 of the race, in the final the following day, that emotion that was caused by the connection that was prompted by the vulnerability enabled them to actually make history and become the first female team to win a silver. So yeah, vulnerability and trust go hand in hand, right?
Yeah. And I think it's saying it's okay to show your vulnerability. And it was something that we had to really work hard at, I'd say, as a crew, because it's very competitive. You're in close confines all the time. And letting people know what your weaknesses are or that you're struggling when you're not in a team yet together. But I think this is where I was able to sort of bring that, because almost in that point in 2014, when I'd said goodbye to that sort of previous version of myself, I said, well, I may not make another team. It's not about me being in this eight in 2016. It's about an eight from Britain winning an Olympic medal, because we believe it's possible for a British women's eight to at last stand on the podium for the first time. And I don't have to be a part of that. So I felt safe. I felt like I would sort of written myself off already in a way. So everything, I wasn't losing anything more by saying, look, these are my weaknesses, or this is what I need help with. Or,
sure,
you know what, you've had a really, really awesome day. You know, I'd love to row with you. Well done.
Yeah. So it comes back to authenticity as well. They're all linked, aren't they? It's like a ball of string overlapping and all that stuff. I'm just going to rattle through a couple of others, because then there's one I want to come back to. And you talk about concentrating, not thinking. And I know you talk as well about only having, say, for example, three things in your mind, and the power of having a low cognitive load. So you're not thinking all the time about, oh, I need to do this and do that. No, you'd have three things. And again, that reminds me of broadcasting, because when people do live, it's good to have three points in your head. You talk about creating, not recreating. So not thinking just because something worked once, it's going to work again, but, you know, continually evolving, creating, learning to let your nerves pass through you like a train, as you say. Confidence not being a thing, it's actually trust and belief. Understanding that pressure is largely self-induced. You talk about seeing things as an opportunity, not a threat, so reframing it. But the one I want to zoom in on is identity. So each time that you, in each of your five Olympics, you had established an identity. I'm interested to what degree you agree with this, but in the sequence of the five games, it seemed to me that there was an evolution in terms of the way you form this identity. So the first one was technical excellence, and then the last one was sassiness. So and I'm trying to find the page where it's got all the others in it, but yeah, so first of all, can you just explain the importance of having an identity as a team, and then also how yours did evolve?
So it's really interesting because when I saw you'd written that about the evolution, I had never thought of it in that prism at all. It had just been each time we had come together as a crew, we'd sat down and said, okay, well, what do we want to define us? What's going to be our sort of our guiding principle by which we operate? And I didn't see any connection from one team sort of progressing from another. So I don't know. I think maybe in the quads it becomes more aggressive, and maybe that's what led possibly to too much physicality, maybe in Beijing. And the women's eight, the sassiness, that was, you know, when you've got such a large group, I think the positive energy is so important. And we really needed something that was more personality focused rather than trying to decide on something technical. And it's quite funny, because it came from, and we were out on the water, it was really bad weather, we were at the European Championships, and the men's eight, our British men's eight, rode past us, And I think I made some like slightly rude comment at them. And all the girls in my boat were so surprised, because I'm normally the sort of the quiet, serious one. And Zoe, our cox, just said, "Oh, it's a bit sassy." Didn't think that was in Fran. And so we just made that our personality. And it was something that we really took on, and again, sort of gave ourselves permission to come back to. So when we were racing, yeah, let ourselves race like this, bring our personality to the day, rather than sort of feel like the day and the pressure and whatever anyone else expects of a day or an Olympics to feel like. This is what we're going to impose and bring to and colour the day with.
Yeah, it's interesting. So I found the page. So 2004, it was technical excellence. 2005, zero tolerance. Next was doing the basics exceptionally well. Then ruthless simplicity and controlling the controllables, and then controlling the controllables, and then on to sassiness, which, as you've just explained there, is more individual and about personality, whereas obviously the technical excellence is very much about, it feels a bit more mechanical. So it just feels to me like over time it softened and became more human.
Yeah. And I think that probably sums up sort of where I got to. Was very much, okay, I'm not the driver. I'm not sort of micromanaging anything. I'm here. I'm one of nine. And, you know, let's just take a helicopter ride and make sure we enjoy what we've got the opportunity to be a part of.
Yeah. Okay. Look, and there's so much other stuff we could talk about, but I think we need to get to, you know, the conclusion and summing it all up really in terms of your journey. And you have a story about a teammate's wife. Correct me again if I'm wrong.
A coach and mentor.
Right. Yeah, and reflecting on that experience made you realize a lot of things.
Yeah. So a friend of mine, Ian Roots, who has helped many, many young aspiring rowers over the last sort of 10, 20 years, he had always been a huge support to me. Whilst I was injured in 2014, his wife, young wife, same age as me, was killed on her bike doing the John O'Groats to Land's End bike ride. And it was after that happened for him, it was realizing that all the people that were around him, you know, sort of day in, day out around him, were through sport. We all knew each other through rowing. And there was one day where, shortly after Anna's funeral, when we went out together, we just sort of took, you know, change of scene, took Ian out for a meal. And there was an Olympic champion there. There were multi-Olympic medalists, Anna's parents, people who'd never been to the Olympics before. But we were all there together. And I just realized, okay, so this really is what sport is so meaningful for. It's that we know each other so well. There's nowhere else we would want to be than supporting and being with such a close friend during the worst days of his life. And sport has given us that relationship and that understanding of each other. And on that evening, that's when I realized that was, you know, that was a line of understanding of what sport really meant to me that I wasn't prepared to cross again. Like, it wasn't about winning at all costs. It was about, look, this is what sport gives us the opportunity to build. It's these relationships that are far, far, far more important than any outcome. And so that day sort of, it was sort of it sealed things for me. And, you know, I just feel so fortunate to have met these people and to have, as I say, formed these relationships. And yeah, it just seems more important to me than success or failure.
Absolutely. Yeah. So it is about shared experiences and relationships, essentially.
Mm. Yeah.
And sport is a metaphor for life.
Yeah, absolutely. As you say, it is a metaphor for life.
You know, if you ask anyone who's been with someone on their deathbed and they're looking back, they're not thinking, you know, it tends to always veer in that direction anyway, doesn't it?
Yeah, it does. It does. Yeah, and I think it always gives you perspective, and perspective is very healthy for me anyway.
Look, you've been on a heck of a journey, Frances. So just to summarise then, if you had to succinctly summarise what you've learnt and what anyone could take from what you've learned and what it teaches you about life and what's important. I mean, we've kind of obviously just done it, but if you were able to just summarise.
I think I'd say it's okay to be yourself and to close the gap between what we intend to do and what we actually do, to continually evolve our understanding of ourselves so we can actually make progress day on day in understanding what for us makes a good day. And if we can have as many good days as possible, then for me that's a good life well lived.
Well said. That was excellent. Succinct and punchy, just what I was looking for. Frances, thank you so much for coming on. It's been a real pleasure talking to you. So three down, one to go. And, yeah. And remember as well, you've got to get me Becky as well. We agreed on that. So that's
my goodness. You want Debbie and Bex. This is a tall order.
There we go. You can tee them up for me. Much appreciated. But no, anyway, thank you very much. It really has been a joy. And I think this is such a conversation for the moment. Like I said, it's one that keeps sort of popping up. And I think a lot of people, you know, doing these kind of shows, if you like, or podcasts, there's a lot of focus on, you know, how to get to the very top and all that kind of stuff. And I think there is an element of missing the trick about actually there's more to it than that. And I think we've covered it here.
I think we have. Yeah.
Excellent. Well done, us. All right. Well, look, thank you so much. It's been a real pleasure talking, and I'll speak to you again soon, no doubt.
Thank you, Simon. Likewise.
Thanks very much for listening to this episode of Don't Tell Me The Score. I really hope you enjoyed our conversation. And I would, of course, be delighted to hear your thoughts, ideas and questions. Do get in touch via my website, simonmundy.com. I do really appreciate you listening. And if you could leave a kind rating and review, I would be sincerely grateful. All that remains is for me to say I hope you'll join me again next time. Until then, thank you and goodbye.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Want your most burning finance and investing questions answered? Here's a podcast you should be listening to, courtesy of Acast Recommends.
Are you ready for some personality in your personal finances? Hi, I'm Janice Torres Rodriguez, Latina money expert and host of the award-winning podcast, Yo Quiero Dinero. On this show, we're serving up POC-friendly personal finance knowledge, always with a side of sass. We're not talking about avocado toast and lattes on this show. We've got real, relatable personal finance knowledge that makes you feel seen, heard, and finally understood. Consider me your super cool, slightly risque, but always honest financial fairy godmother. Together, we'll tackle dinero in a fresh new way so you can finally become poderosa with your dinero. Check out our weekly podcast episodes at YoQuieroDineroPodcast.com or subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.